In Claremont, an alleged racially motivated incident between white teenagers and a younger biracial boy has shaken the community over the past several weeks. The victim's family says it's an open-and-shut case of racism. The teenager's family says the kids were playing with a rope and climbing trees when things went tragically wrong. They say it was not the attempted lynching that some are making it out to be. The incident has similarly divided the community as a whole. Some say it points to long-running racism in the area. Others say that's blowing things out of proportion. NHPR's Brita Green reports.
Daddy Pop's Tumble In Diner in Claremont is one of those metal-sided diner cars straight out of the 1940s. Inside, Fallon Carter, the owner's daughter, is talking about the alleged attack with her mom and a friend. They're sitting on the other side of the counter as she works, the vent fan over the griddle on full blast.
He just so happened to be of a different origin. I mean, we're all Americans here. We're all from a different area of the world.
Carter says she doesn't know what the motivation was, but it's probably just bullying. That is a problem here. Her friend, Natalie Jarvis, jumps
in. That was my point, that if that hadn't been the method of the bullying, then this wouldn't have been probably interpreted and blown up this way as a racist thing.
Race, owner Deborah Kirby adds, is not an issue in Claremont. After all, the city is more than 95% white.
Well, other than there are people that are like so-called, that I don't know, skinheads or what, supremacists, whatever, and you'll see swastika tattoos and stuff.
Around town.
Yeah, and I don't even see them really bothering anybody. I think because we're not inner city. We're still out in the boonies, kinda. So in this area, I don't find that racism is a problem.
I've heard this perspective a fair amount over the past several weeks. And at the city level, while the city manager and mayor denounce racism, they say broader anti-violence efforts are a good way to respond. They haven't wanted to focus on just race. Others say that response misses the point.
The idea that an act like putting a noose around someone's neck could be called, oh, they were just kidding around, this is bullying. That's not bullying.
That's Rachel Edens. She lives about 25 miles up the road from Claremont, where she advises Black, first-generation, and low-income college students. And she also works on issues like diversity and inclusivity. She's from the South and says, moving to this area, she was stunned at the level of racism she's encountered. She says at one point, there were 3 Confederate flags visible just on the street where she lives.
There's definitely a feeling of not being welcomed, of being in danger, of always wondering when something is going to happen.
Olivia Lapeer is a racial justice organizer in the Upper Valley. She says she hears this idea that was brought up in the diner often, that there just aren't that many people of color here, and therefore race isn't an issue.
Which is, I mean, first you're denying the existence of people of color who do live here and their experiences and their oppression. But in addition to, you're saying that that racism only exists where Black people exist, that we are the problem and we bring the problems with us.
Lapeer says, in her experience, even well-intentioned people don't stick around to make lasting change over the long term. She spoke at a vigil in town after the incident hit the news, leading the crowd in a Black Lives Matter chant. A smaller group met again last week.
What we're planning to do is
about 40 people, mostly white, several from out of town, sat in folding chairs in a church meeting room downtown. Amy Cousins was one of them. She drove about an hour to be here with 2 of her children. She's white. Her husband is Black.
I grew up in these small towns. I feel happy and comfortable in these small towns. I feel, for the most part, happy and comfortable with my children and my husband. But there are incidents that come at us, smaller, but there's that fear of bigger.
The group broke into small discussion circles. They answered prompts like, what do you like about the community where you live, and what do you think could be improved? Cousins' children joined the discussion for a while. Adia is 10.
The people that I just randomly meet are nice, and they don't really bring up anything about, my skin tone or anything like that.
But Adia also has teenage siblings, and her mom says as they've gotten older, they get more comments around their race.
You know, things that teenagers think are jokey, but I've also taught them when push comes to shove, people who they think might be on their side will not necessarily be on their side.
In the small groups, participants were also asked whether they'd personally witnessed an act of discrimination and what they did about it. This, racial justice advocates say, is one area where people can really help, learning to intervene, to have those hard conversations day to day. As the meeting wrapped up, its organizer said she'll plan another gathering next month. Bring a friend, she said. For a city of 13,000, they could use a few more people to make a difference. For NHPR News, I'm Brita Green.
The first few weeks of school in the towns of Durham, Lee, and Madbury have been clouded by allegations of racist bullying on a school bus. NHPR's Jason Moon recently sat down with the superintendent of the school district and the parents of the alleged victim to hear how each are grappling with the situation.
On a Friday afternoon in early September, Benjamin Caudill was waiting at the bus stop to meet his son at the end of the school day. The Caudills recently moved to New Hampshire from Kentucky, and for 7-year-old Joseph Caudill, this was just his third day of school in a new town in a new state. When the bus arrived, Benjamin says something wasn't right. The bus driver motioned for him to come on to the bus.
So I got up and I came over there, and Joseph was on the bus crying, and I asked the bus driver what's wrong, and she looked at me and said, "It's bad. It's that."
And what is that? That is our skin color.
That's Grace Caudill, Joseph's mom. Skin color and what it can mean is something the Caudills have wrestled with more than most. Grace is black and originally from Jamaica, though she's lived in the U.S. for more than 20 years. Benjamin is white and grew up in Kentucky. The couple has 5 children who, as Grace puts it, are of all shades of the rainbow. When Grace got a new job at UNH, they moved to Durham and enrolled their kids in the local schools. Joseph was on his way home from his new school when he says a boy sitting next to him on the bus bullied him with racist language, telling him that, quote, whites are over blacks.
Me being the dad, I get instantly angry and protective. I'm like, I step up into the bus. I'm like, who said this to my child?
Benjamin says eventually a boy came forward. He asked him what happened.
This little child looks me in my eyes and says, "I didn't want to sit beside dark-skinned people." So I looked at him and I said, "The same blood that goes through your veins goes through Joseph's veins. The same heart that beats in your chest beats in Joseph's chest." He looked downcast and dejected. I think it was more from the shock of Joseph's dad is Caucasian. I really do believe that. And here I am, I'm telling him, you know, you're the same.
Later, Grace watched video of the incident from a surveillance camera on the bus.
From what they showed me, it was 48 minutes of terror on our child. You could hear the aggressor making gorilla grunts at my son. My son had no idea what it meant.
Grace says the video also showed the boy hitting Joseph with a baseball and a backpack. Along with the shock of the incident itself, the Caudills have also been upset with how the school district has handled the situation so far. Oyster River Superintendent Jim Morse says he's tried his best to respond to their concerns.
The family came in with 15 requests of me, and as of today, we're meeting every single one of those requests.
Those requests included seeing the video of the incident and paying for counseling sessions for Joseph. But the Caudills say the video they saw wasn't complete and that the number of counseling sessions is limited. They remain in contact with the district about further steps they say need to happen. One thing they all agree on is that this goes beyond what happened between 2 boys on a school bus, that it requires a broader, community-wide response. Morse says a review of the district's curriculum as it relates to diversity and inclusion is underway. He says a similar review of the district's discrimination policies is also ongoing. All staff members will be required to participate in diversity training over the next few months, and a community forum is being scheduled for sometime next month.
We want to be the model. We want to be the system that believes in inclusion and believes in diversity and believes in acceptance. This really gave us a shot in the arm to get going.
For the Caudills, while their son is no longer on the same bus, they still worry about what they'll hear from their kids when they get home each day. Just one day after the incident on the bus with their son, their daughter told them she had been the target of racist jokes in a classroom. But the Coghills haven't been alone in all this. Since they began speaking out, Grace says other parents from across the state have reached out to them, offering sympathy and support.
These are parents who are just like us. Mom or dad is Caucasian or dad is African American, and their children have experienced moments of racial denigration and racial hate in school.
Grace says her son wasn't alone on that bus either. When she watched the video, she saw several children speak up on Joseph's behalf. Grace says one boy even moved seats to put himself in between her son and the bully. She says she's not sure if the parents of that child know how brave he was. For NHPR News, I'm Jason Moon.
In recent weeks, the University of New Hampshire has seen a string of racially charged incidents play out on campus. As NHPR's Jason Moon reports, the events are forcing a difficult conversation just days before graduation.
Danique Montague says May 5th was a trying day for her. As she walked to and from class across the campus of UNH, she saw many white students dressed in sombreros and ponchos for Cinco de Mayo. Montague, who is black, sees the costumes as offensive examples of cultural appropriation, and she felt compelled to say so.
You're making them a costume. How is that not appropriating something?
What are you talking about?
You're dressing as what stereotypical Mexican would be like instead of appreciating their culture.
And I'm having fun.
Montague posted the video of this altercation on social media, where it exploded. It was shared more than 3,000 times, and hundreds of commenters weighed in on both sides of the argument.
I just wanted UNH to know how I felt and how other people of color felt on campus during celebrations like this.
The episode captures the mood on campus after what's been a difficult few weeks at UNH, with students, faculty, and staff wrestling with themes of diversity and inclusion at the majority white school. In the days after Cinco de Mayo, a social media post mocking Montague and appearing to depict blackface was widely shared. Later, swastikas were found drawn on the wall of a student dorm. Then, a racial epithet targeting African Americans was found graffitied in another campus building. UNH Police Chief Paul Dean did not respond to repeated requests for comment, but in written statements confirmed that at least three incidents are under criminal investigation.
It gives a sense of, dread.
That's Spencer Littles, a senior at UNH and a member of the Black Student Union. He says events like this have happened on campus before, but not with this frequency. Other minority students, like Brianna Garcia, who came to UNH from Denver, describe a less obvious but no less troubling form of discrimination.
Coming here, it's very different. Like, the biases are subtle, but, like, you still notice them all the time. And I can't handle it anymore. I need to leave.
Garcia has decided to transfer to Texas State University. And while there's plenty of frustration among these students for the perpetrators of these acts, they've also been upset by what they call the lackluster response from university officials. Members of the Black Student Union and other groups staged a protest at UNH administrators' offices demanding action. That led to a tense 3-hour forum with students, faculty, and staff last week. UNH President Mark Huddleston addressed the crowd, calling the incidents vile and also acknowledging that they aren't the first of their kind at UNH.
I think I said I've been here for 10 years, and almost every one of those 10 years, we've had some version of this conversation. And I understand your frustration. I can't fully appreciate it, but I understand it. And I know that that frustration extends back even beyond the 10 years that I've been here.
Huddleston referenced a set of demands made by the Black Student Union in 1998. Among those demands were for UNH to enroll at least 300 black students by 2004. Today, out of an undergraduate population of about 12,000, there are 165 black students. That's just over 1%.
That's deeply frustrating, I know. So I think we need to work together again to try to figure out how to make some progress.
One person who will be at the center of UNH's attempt to make progress is Jamie Nolan. She's vice president for community, equity, and diversity.
It's really important that we are transparent, that we acknowledge our failings, where we're challenged.
She says the past few weeks have revealed some uncomfortable facts about campus climate. But she says the UNH community shouldn't shy away from the tension.
Because the tension is where all the possibility is. If we avoid the tension, then we're avoiding the very things that where we might actually find meaningful action or potentially solutions.
For the moment, the action has largely been talking about the problem. And some minority students say they do feel that at least now they're being heard. But for those interested in continuing the conversation, the immediate challenge is the approach of summer. Graduation ceremonies take place tomorrow, and many students have already left campus, which means we may not know until next year whether this uncomfortable moment for UNH will be a learning one as well. For NHBR News, I'm Jason Moon.
As students are preparing to return for another academic year at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, for some, there's still unfinished business from last year. After a series of racist campus incidents, students of color called upon the administration to make UNH a safer, more inclusive space. This included a list of demands. Producer Jimmy Gutierrez checks in on how those demands are being handled and discovers why this story may have you feeling a bit of deja vu.
Last year, there were close to 100 reported bias incidents at UNH. They included the vandalizing of school property with racial slurs and swastikas, while some students report having been spit on or having rocks thrown at them.
I have family from all over that are messaging me, like, are you okay? Like, what's going on your campus? Like, you know, and when we were meeting with administration, they just seemed so kind of nonchalant about the whole situation, and that's really, really frustrating.
This is Gabby Graves, and she's a senior at UNH. She helped organize a group of students that presented a list of 16 demands to the university's administration this past May. For this story, we're looking at one specific demand. It's a call for a cultural competency course that all students would be required to take before graduating. This includes raising awareness on the effects of implicit bias and stereotypes.
I think a course like that, one would inform students on how to learn about other cultures that aren't your own.
This also isn't the first time students have made a call for a class like this.
Hello, Chandra Craven
speaking. Hey, Chandra, this is Jimmy. How you doing?
Good, how are you?
Chandra Craven went to UNH from 1995 through 99. She's originally from Boston and says she could go days on campus without seeing another person of color.
I don't think people quite understand it, but when you say it and you break it down and you say, one of 12 black females on a campus of 12,000 people, then they get it.
Chandra grew up navigating majority white spaces. But even that couldn't prepare her for some of the things she would hear at UNH.
I had a girl who came up to me and said, what's wrong with your hands? And I was like, what are you talking about? What's wrong with my hands? She goes, well, it's dark on one side and it's light on the other. And I said, excuse me? Apparently, she had never met a person of color in real life. Those kind of questions just were a constant thing. And you never turn it off.
In the fall of 98, after repeatedly asking the university to address race relations, students from the Black Student Union staged a sit-in in then-President Joan Lutzel's office. They drafted a list of demands titled Broken Promises. This included a call for a cultural competency course.
That cultural competence wasn't just for the students to help us feel more comfortable on campus. It was also for leadership and for teachers. Because also, let's not forget, on the other end of that, we had maybe like 3 teachers of color on campus.
This past May, one of the tensest moments on campus came after a few students posted photos on their social media wearing ponchos and fake mustaches while joking about deportation. The issue of cultural appropriations or distorting an oppressed group's culture was also happening on campus in the 90s. There's another nugget here that I think we need to get into. Sisters in STEP.
Oh, let's hit it. I knew you were going to take it there.
Sisters in STEP is a STEP group that was started at UNH by 3 women of color in the late 90s. Chandra was an original member.
If you look at STEP, it's a combination of hip-hop meets like traditional African call-and-response dance rhythm.
When Sisters in STEP started, it gave women of color a team of their own. A year later, the group decided to invite men of color to join. Today, people on campus say that the diverse group that started as a place of refuge has become an almost entirely white team. UNH students have even said that a few women of color were cut from the group at tryouts. Sisters in STEP didn't respond to our request for comments.
It hurts me to the very core of my being. I'm sorry, I'm going to cry here. Literally almost saved my life because I was at my wit's end of being at UNH.
One administrator who's been on campus since the 90s remembers a different UNH.
A lot of people today will say, well, look, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. But having been there at the time, I can tell you that it really was a big push into the future.
Dean of Students Ted Kirkpatrick was on the receiving end of those demands in 98 and says the university has worked out a lot of those issues. In the late 90s, there were 2 African-American student body presidents. Representation for students of color on campus has jumped from 1% to 8%. But one demand that has not been met is a course on cultural competency.
From your point of view, what is the value of having a class like that? And would that class have made a difference if it would have been on campus for the last 20 years or so?
The answer to the last part of your question is absolutely.
Do you feel like the administration has done enough for students of color on this campus?
Never. I mean, even if we got A grades, the minute you get complacent, you're dead. So, no.
One difference with today's demands from those of 98 is that the dean himself is named.
The last demand is that I, if these things aren't done by the end of the coming academic year, that I'm replaced in my job as dean of students.
Kirkpatrick says there's still work to be done, and the administration is taking steps in the right direction.
This fall, we have a cluster hire of 3 African-American faculty. If you asked me to predict that last year, well, boy, the odds are long on that. Somehow they did it. White people did that.
UNH students on campus this fall will be working on these issues and waiting to see how the administration responds, even as many on campus don't see a problem.
Within like my peers, from like what I've noticed, they kind of think we're blowing it out of proportion. They don't see it as like a much larger issue that's been going on for decades.
Gabby Graves, like Chandra Craven, knows the effects of being a student of color at UNH. While she's battled depression, others have transferred or dropped out because of the campus's environment.
To have students come to like the university, have to deal with racism, homophobia, transphobia on a daily basis, and then still have to perform the same as like their counterparts who aren't dealing with those type of systematic interpersonal discriminatory like experiences, that is really difficult and it takes a huge toll on you mentally and emotionally.
The question facing all sides is whether or not students will be returning to a university that's ready to address these issues, or if this conversation will be passed down to another generation of students. For NHPR News, I'm Jimmy Gutierrez.
After a string of racially charged incidents embroiled the University of New Hampshire campus last school year, administrators promised a renewed focus on diversity and inclusion. NHPR's Jason Moon reports on what that effort looks like so far and how it's being received.
Last May, the atmosphere on campus at UNH was tense. A video showing a confrontation between students about racist stereotypes on Cinco de Mayo went viral. So did images of students wearing blackface. Swastikas and racial slurs started showing up graffitied on campus. Then sculptures installed to show solidarity for minority students in the midst of all this were vandalized. Altogether, there were close to 100 incidents of bias reported at UNH last year. 3 of those reports sparked criminal investigations. And all of it left a bad taste that still lingers for some students like Brennan Donnell.
I was kind of ashamed to be a UNH student that day, honestly. I mean, I hate Cinco de Mayo because of this, but last year, this past spring especially, was just not good.
And it wasn't just students who were affected. Julian Kwame is a staff member at UNH.
It's not something that I was concerned about until the student thing happened. And I said, oh, if this thing can happen to a student, maybe it can happen to me.
In a speech to graduating students in May, UNH President Mark Huddleston said, quote, this is not who we are. He added that the university would address the issues forcefully. That effort is now some 6 months old. And so far, a big part of it has been a slew of diversity-themed events on campus. In October, hundreds of students crowded into a lecture hall for what was billed as a teach-in on cultural appropriation. That is, taking things from another culture without showing an understanding of or respect for that culture. The event was put together by a group of faculty, including Spanish professor Scott Weintraub.
The one event today cannot help to solve anything, but we hope it will be seen as a genuine effort on the part of individual faculty members to respond to some urgent needs for education around diversity and inclusion and for the support of students of color at the University of New Hampshire.
At this event, a handful of faculty gave short talks on topics like the history of blackface and the difference between Halloween and the Mexican holiday Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. And they also shared some of their personal feelings about how these issues have affected them.
And the word that I've come to dread every Cinco de Mayo, every Halloween, and lots of other times around the year, that word is just.
Stephen Trascoma teaches classical mythology at UNH. He's also Mexican-American.
When you put on that sombrero or that bigote, the mustache, you are tying into decades and decades and decades of stereotypes of negative portrayals. So when somebody sees you doing that, it is not just having fun or just putting on a funny hat or just doing anything to the person who is looking at you who is connected to that culture.
Elsewhere on campus, some students, faculty, and staff have been attending training events on how to respond to acts of bias in the moment. There have been panel discussions with law professors about hate speech and free speech, events focused on inclusion for LGBTQ students, on tackling racial and gender bias in STEM fields, on what white people can do to combat racism. But are all these events working? Is this the right approach?
The likelihood is that individuals who were predisposed to appear in blackface aren't necessarily taking part in these diversity training issues.
That's Rogers Johnson, president of the Seacoast chapter of the NAACP. He's also a UNH alum and a member of a task force on campus climate that the university created in response to the events in May. Johnson says UNH is doing some things right. He gives them a grade of a C+ overall. But he says the university could be a lot more aggressive, especially when it comes to addressing threatening hate speech on social media, something he and others have seen online.
There's a law that says you cannot threaten someone in public, and social media is public. The university should be telling students that if they do that, they could be held accountable to the UNH police and then prosecuted by the Stratford County attorney. Why they won't make send that message out is beyond me.
UNH says it is reporting any criminal threatening to police, and it says it's working on updating its policies in the student handbook about student speech on social media. Johnson says he worries that UNH could wind up like another school that recently struggled with racial tensions, the University of Missouri. A few years ago, huge student protests there about racial discrimination led to the resignation of top university officials. Afterwards, undergraduate enrollment plummeted by more than 35%. 7 dorms were closed, and more than 400 staff and faculty were let go.
So that's what I'm worried about, that they're not careful and they create that scenario.
UNH officials say they've made real progress on these issues over the last several months, and they stress that the work is just beginning. In March, the Task Force on Campus Climate will present its findings to the UNH community. Those will include a set of recommendations on where to go next. For NHPR News, I'm Jason Moon.